Delivering a new technology to market takes time, and for healthcare and life sciences, requires very high quality standards. All of this comes at a cost. So how can you convince investors and other funders to show you the money? Hello, and welcome to The Evidence Space, a podcast from the Institution of Engineering and Technology, which brings you interviews with leaders from health, care, and life sciences. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Bannister, and throughout this series, we've heard about the various stages and activities that are involved in the validation of new technologies for use in healthcare and life sciences. All of these activities take time and come at a cost. So how can you attract funding for these activities? How can you drive forwards development before you're actually able to generate revenue from their use in a clinical setting? To help us answer these questions, I'm delighted to welcome to the Evidence Space, Dr. Ranjan Nag and Martin Hunt. Ranjan, Martin, welcome to the Evidence Space.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be here.
Hello, Peter. Great to be here too.
Can I ask you both to introduce yourselves? And something we like to do on the Evidence Space is to ask our guests to give us a fun fact about themselves.
Okay, I'll start. Thank you, Peter, for the introduction. My name's Ranjan Nag. I'm actually here in San Francisco, right in front of the Golden Gate Bridge. And my background, electrical engineering, of course, being here at the IET. But then went on to do speech recognition at Cambridge, and then management science at MIT, and then the Department of Psychology at Stanford. And basically, after all that, no one would give me a job. So I had to get companies funded, and I had to start companies. Started one that sold to Motorola, another one that sold to BlackBerry, another one that sold to Apple. And I live in San Francisco, and I run the R42 Institute, which funds companies, starts companies, and also informs about science, technology, and artificial intelligence.
Are you willing to offer up a fun fact?
Yes, my first job was working in the factory for Avon Cosmetics, putting on the tops of nail varnish bottles.
That's a lot of fun facts. That's great, Ranjan. Thank you very much for the introduction. Martin, over to you.
So hi there. My background is initially in big US multinationals, where I spent 15 years climbing the greasy pole. Started out in pharmaceuticals. I've been a pharmaceutical rep, done market research, and I've done product management, and then I've been a marketing director. I managed to get out of there and because I was, whilst I'd enjoyed the experience, I needed to get into early stage. So I left and I've done now 9 roles in either as a CEO, chairman, or investor in early stage medtechs. I've done the journey from startup through angel funding, IPO, a couple of secondaries, and an exit to Covidien. And when that happened, I came home and I felt very triumphant. And I said to my wife, "What do you think about that, Ben?" And she said to me, "Well, I don't want to see any more of you than I've been seeing, so go find something to do." So since then, as I say, I currently chair two life science companies. One I put on AIM in 2017, having sworn I'd never do another IPO, but it's a lot easier as chairman. And I'm also a founding investor and chairman of a company in the regenerative medicine space. I guess my fun fact is, briefly, I held the lap record at Silverstone Motor Racing Circuit. I used to own a TVR. I was a member of the TVR Owners Club, and we were allowed to get track days. So I took my TVR Camara around Silverstone, did 123 miles down Hanger Straight, virtually lost it at Stowe, and came around and felt fantastic until 10 minutes later, a guy in a Griffith went and bettered me. But for 10 minutes, I held the lap record at Silverstone.
Wow, that's some accolade. I'm sure both of your experiences will appeal to at least the engineers in the audience. I think it'll be very clear to those listening that between the two of you, you both represent a huge amount of experience in different facets of the investment industry across this very broad range of sectors, including cutting edge applications such as artificial intelligence and regenerative medicine. So I'm really keen that during the conversation, we try and tease out some of the key messages to others who know a lot less about this space, either engineers who haven't yet worked in healthcare or those already in an SME healthcare or life sciences environment looking to scale up and make a real impact on global health and patient care. Perhaps we can start by outlining some of those different sources of funding that are out there for people who are looking to develop and launch technologies in this space. What are the key types of funding for a startup company that they might look for?
Right. Well, I think it's probably different from the UK and the US. Certainly in the UK, I see more grant funding than there is here in the US. There is grant funding in life sciences in particular here in the US, but often there's probably a greater emphasis of venture capital. Clearly, I think one of the things in startup land, it depends on what kind of company you are doing in life sciences. Do you need a lot of wet lab space, or is it more computational where you can just simply sit in your bedroom and start typing code? The classic case is getting angel investments in the US, which in Silicon Valley is quite a lot of activity. There's probably about 20 angel groups. These are people where people club together, and they usually have other jobs or they're retired and they want to help small companies. 20 groups in the Silicon Valley area by itself. Whereas if you go to Manchester, there might be only one, the whole group. I don't know, you might know better. But usually I like to companies get a deal somewhere, even if it's only £10,000 or $10,000 or $20,000. Someone pays something for it. And that's what angel investors are saying. Well, there's someone actually interested in what you're actually doing. If you actually did it, would anyone actually pay attention? There are many, many sources of funding in the UK, which are more grant-oriented. If you're actually attached to a university, often there are academic programs. There's a program called the iCure program in the UK, and the equivalent in the US is iCorps, where you're giving $50,000 to $50,000 in the US, £25,000, I believe, in the UK, to go and go through the lean startup process. So what is the lean startup process? Basically, engineers, we're classic. We always want to make something that's best and the perfect. And this actually gets you out of the lab, out of the office, and actually talk to real customers. You've got to talk to 100 people and try and extract from them what is it they actually need. And sometimes what they're verbalizing is not really what they're actually needing. And so that's the whole idea. Get out there and talk to people before you even write a single line of code, before you build anything, figure out what people want. So there's a few things. I'll stop there. I'm sure Martin's got some excellent other ideas.
That's a great range. Martin, I appreciate you have experience in the US as well, but how in particular does that contrast with Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ron John's right. Whilst we have a very well-developed venture capital sector here in the UK compared to Europe, it probably pales into relative insignificance with the US. So if I've got a young company coming to me, my first advice is go and mine the public space, which is very well developed here. You've got Innovate UK, you've got my own, the NIHR, you've got a variety of other public funding bodies, which will give you in some form either a grant, a convertible loan, or some other instrument. And these instruments here can be quite significant. So I run the I4I program for the NIHR. The biggest funding we've given as a grant was $4 million for a group in Oxford doing virtual reality. I think you go and look at that space, but you also have to engage with other investors. What my program, the I4I program, seeks to do is to de-risk these propositions such that they can then go on and attract angel funding. I'm not sure that, it's a conversation we can have about where the venture's gone from venture capital, because it's not quite as venturesome as it used to be, in my view. I think the key differences between the US and the UK are the availability of public and grant funding. And really, you need to go out and understand that landscape, because it can be quite formative, actually, in building a company.
So it sounds like a key requirement for anyone looking to innovate in this space is to understand where specific policies and societal needs exist. One example you mentioned was the incentives on offer in Japan to encourage the development of technologies for an elderly population. So clearly there needs to be an alignment in terms of understanding why certain regions of the world and certain organizations might be inclined to invest in particular technologies. Another aspect that you both highlighted very clearly is the risks in investing in some of these companies at an early stage, and also the long wait until they're on the market and able to produce some revenue. So why would investors fund companies at an early stage with high risk? What do they find attractive about the investment proposition? And what kind of evidence are they looking for? It's too early for a clinical trial to have taken place, right?
Yes, certainly. Well, I come from the tech area, from computer science, and you know, us computer scientists are now muscling into biology, so it's starting to take over. So, you know, trying to use computational techniques to try and predict new drugs and have new medical devices. And it did come to me as an eye-opener as I started entering the biotech area. Now, why do people invest and what are the dynamics? So one dynamic is compared to tech is you can actually get a valuation. You can actually be valuable without actually having any revenues just because of this concept. If you actually have a patent and you've actually had trials, people know the statistics of once you've gone through a set of trials and the further along you have actually got through a phase two trial out of three phases, you now have a 33% chance of succeeding. And so that has value, even though you've not sold a single treatment. And so you have value just on that basis itself. Conversely, if you also see where people just won't invest, like in the case of antibiotics, where people are going out of business when they've tried, yet we need it. Now, you have another pandemic and you have a bacterial infection where there is no antibiotic and people haven't been researching and developing antibiotics because there's no market for there. That's where sort of government kind of has to step in because investors won't do that. The third dynamic is the problem, is the issue of diversification. You can do, I've got like 55 positions, for example, at the moment. And if you diversify, then you can actually, you know, smooth out those high-risk variations where it's 5% chance or 25% chance. And if you put on top of that some macro trends of using computation, for example, to try and invent a new drug at 1/20th the cost, at 1/20th the time, which I think is a big macro trend coming across. And several companies in that area getting huge valuations, huge investment rounds to really disrupt, you know, almost Google-like that space in trying to do something. And so you can actually go, you know, even though the drug's going to take 18 years, 16 years to get out there, even at the 6-year point, 7-year point, when you've got a phase one or phase two trial, you will have value. And so, and then guess what? Unlike in tech, you have like 10 years of exclusivity where competitors have more limited ability to attack you. So it's not all bad news from an investor point of view. There's some pluses as well. And that's why people are doing it.
So clearly from a technology perspective, for an investment proposition, there's ways of breaking down and quantifying the value at different steps along that journey rather than just at the end. Martin, given your experience, if we take an example which might have a relatively shorter development timeline, let's imagine some kind of new digital health tool, what kind of evidence are you looking for from teams at a very early stage of development to convince you that it's going to be successful and that they know how to make it successful?
Yeah, that's kind of the $64 million question, isn't it? If you can put that combination together and get it right, then it's really very powerful. I think in the med tech sector, I think one of the attractions to people investing early in there is, generally speaking, the kind of trialing, the evidence building is not binary. So, and I think that's quite fundamental to a lot of people. Med tech, I think, let's be honest, for decades, it's been the Cinderella for investors. The big sector has always been biotech because if it comes off, it comes off hugely. The problem is the balance of biotech coming off in those stellar quantities has dramatically reduced. So I think what we are seeing now, I'm seeing a market is changing too. The barrier between pharmaceuticals and devices is blurring. Regenerative medicine is blurring that that whole barrier. You can have stem cell treatments. Is that a drug? Is it a device? How does the regulator see it? So I think that's playing into things.
We've talked a lot about the evidence that the technology might need, but a phrase that I've heard a lot is investors invest in people. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about the evidence that an investor would need to see for the team, not the technology, to be convinced to provide backing to these companies. When you're considering investing in early stage technology teams, what's the preferred or optimal kind of configuration of skills and experiences you're looking for in those small groups?
Well, okay, so I'll have a go. I'll chime in. So I think in life sciences and biotech, I think it's getting a little bit of a different trend from like a few years ago, where it's often people from the medtech, biotech, life sciences industry directly. I'm seeing a lot more interdisciplinary teams now from different backgrounds, either from computer science and biology or electrical engineering and life sciences on the device side. And sometimes you see almost pure play non-life science teams, and you ask, well, I'd rather have more of a mixed thing, but you've got this thing in the back of your mind, well, okay, are they being disruptive? Are they doing something that the incumbents are not thinking about and they can't think about because they're incumbent coming across? We've seen some of the, this, particularly some of this in the longevity space, where people are coming in from other fields, getting some experience in life sciences, and trying to sort of make a go of it. I think investors still like a balanced team. The companies themselves then have to have this challenge of how do they get different disciplines to work together, right? If you come from a computer science background, mathematics background, and then you've got biology who doesn't, how do you get them, how do you get 1 + 1 = 3 in the life? So I'll stop there and maybe Martin can comment.
Martin, I'm interested to understand, other than the core technical and scientific skills, what are the fundamental business competences that you want to see in those early teams? Again, to give you confidence that they've got it, what it takes to move the technology onto the next stage.
Yeah, I agree with Ron John in terms of the changing mix of people. So I have a couple of, they're not hard and fast rules, but I have a couple of rules, and it applies if I'm investing English taxpayers' money, or if I'm playing around with my own. I want to see someone in there that really fundamentally understands the technology that we talk about. And I mean to a deep dive, really, really understand it. They may be the founder. I'm not that bothered, but I want someone that really truly can go through the diligence and can get right the way down to page 50, 55, 60 and still be competent. If you're raising money, I've always felt as an investor, you need someone that knows about managing the money that you're putting into the company. So I like to see a finance director, a CFO, but someone in there that has knowledge. And generally speaking, they're the ones that will set up, they'll do the technical behind the scenes stuff. You always give the rubbish jobs to the FD, the CFO. But you absolutely need those people. I think investors want that confidence. And then you want someone that far too often, if stuff comes out of a university, for example, you get this naive, well, what's the channel to market? How are you going to introduce this into the NHS? Well, I'll license it to Smith and Nephew. No, you won't, will you? It's not going to happen. Do you know how difficult the... And that, so I'm looking for someone that has got some form of track record in overcoming hurdles, breaking down barriers and getting a technology into a sector. It doesn't matter which sector. And actually in that, I'm often looking for someone that's, if you're looking at a commercial animal, someone that's failed in the past. If you it's the old adage, if you haven't failed, you haven't tried. And this, when I see people that have got these perfect CVs and perfect track records, I tend to glaze over because I think I'm being sold a pup there. So I like to see that mixture of competencies among them, number one. And number two, when you watch them present, have they just met in the lobby or have they actually thought their way through what they're going to present. You get a relatively short space of time to present your idea and your concept. Present it properly, professionally, the way you've thought it through. You know, there are other features around that, but those are sort of my watchwords really for the kind of expertise I'm looking for.
I think you've touched on a really interesting point, because a lot of investors talk about what they bring in addition to money. Some of the contribution in kind that the investors can provide in terms of market experience and maybe operational support must vary between different funding mechanisms and between different regions. In terms of the chief executive or managing director role, you both talked about the growing frequency of seeing very multidisciplinary technical product teams. Does the early stage chief executive or CEO need to have life sciences or medical device experience to be successful in driving a technology forwards in this particular sector?
Well, I think I see a couple of trends. I mean, I think it's less, it depends on what they're doing, right? Obviously, it's a device, it's more of an engineering kind of emphasis. If it's a computational drug discovery, then you probably get away. If it's a pure chemistry, biochemistry, then it's probably more of a life science thing. Often these companies are set up by young people, postdocs, or you know, PhD plus a couple of years, or undergraduate plus a couple of years. The best model I've seen is where you have a young dynamic person, not to say older people are not dynamic, but matched with someone who's had a long 20-year experience in the industry, who knows everybody, knows all the things that have gone wrong. And the combination, if they can get on well with each other, it can be work extremely well. Sometimes they don't get on with each other. That's another issue. But if you can get that where the chemistry's working, the personality mix works, that's the best thing. And whether that person's the young person's CEO or the old person's the CEO and the young person's CTO, I don't think that matters as much. Clearly in any industry, it helps if you know people. But often it takes a few years to get your thing out. So after 2 or 3 years, certainly the industries I've been in myself, now I knew nobody, but after a couple of years, you do know people. And these companies last 5, 6, 8, 10 years. By the time you've got to 5, 8 years, you know some young people, they'll know people as well. So you can build that up.
I'm hearing there's lots of different ways to imbue those early stage teams with the kind of industry experience that investors are looking for to give the investors confidence that they're going to be able to have a good chance of success. Both people who've got firsthand experience, as well as the contacts that come with having worked in healthcare or medtech or life sciences for a number of years. Ron, John, Martin, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I still feel that we've a lot to talk about, so maybe we can continue our conversation on the next episode of The Evidence Space. On this episode of The Evidence Space, we've started to scratch the surface of how you go about obtaining funding for the development of a new technology for healthcare or life sciences. Funding can come from different sources, both private and also from the public sector, typically in the form of grants. And the requirements for obtaining these kinds of funding will vary, and vary even further as you start to consider the health economic requirements of different regions of the world. While the product development cycles associated with healthcare and life sciences are typically long, we've also heard how it's possible to break them down into interim objectives and milestones so that investors can see a return on their investment over shorter timescales and convince them to invest. We've also heard about how your team will need to grow and add different skills as you move through this journey and continue to attract funding, and what you can do to make sure that you have the right skills in your team. We hope that you found this episode informative. If you have suggestions for a future episode of The Evidence Space, please do get in touch. Thank you very much for listening.